welcome once again to the monthly BV Magazine podcast, your authentic slice of rural Dorset life. This is episode 2 for March 2024. It's hello from me, Terry Bennett.
And hello from me, Jenny Devitt.
In this episode, I speak to retired Colonel Guy Deacon about a trip which took him from Dorset all the way to the southern tip of Africa, raising awareness along the way about Parkinson's disease, a condition from which he suffers.
And I talk to owner and manager of the very successful Sturminster Newton Boxing Club, Sean Weeks.
You can hear my interview with John Farrand of the Great Taste Awards, an organisation based in Gillingham, Dorset, but which has an international reach and now attracts well over 10,000 entries each year. Guy Deacon, CBE, is a retired army colonel who was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease during 2011. Despite this, he carried on serving for a further 8 years before retiring in 2019 and almost immediately embarking on an epic journey which would eventually take him from his home near Sanford Orcus to Cape Town on the southern tip of Africa. I started by asking Guy about his army career.
Yes, I was in the army from 1985 to 2019, so a full career spent in the Royal Armoured Corps. And my last job was in Bovington, down the road, of course. I spent the right amount of time in Germany, because we all did in those days, but I also spent a lot of time in other places as well, because I always took every advantage I possibly could to make the most of the opportunities that were presented to me. So I spent time in Belize, Mauritius, Central Africa, Canada, obviously, lots of time in Germany and Scotland and England. But
you are a native of this part of the world. You went to Sherborne School, I believe, and still live in the locality.
Yeah, I grew up in near Amesbury in Wiltshire, but I was at school down here, and I worked down here, and I loved Dorset, so it's very much home from home, and I was always going to come back and live here eventually. And my wife, who didn't know, was quite wedded to Scotland, but then she came down very happily as well and loves it equally as much.
And what took you into the army in the first place? Was that always going to be your destiny, or your military family, or did it sort of come out of the blue a bit?
I've done my very best to make no decisions in my life, and I've always drifted along quite happily to where I ended up. And my father was in the army. And I don't remember being persuaded to join the army or over-encouraged, but I think he was probably quite happy that I did join the army. It was just a natural thing to do. And I passed all the right sort of qualifications to get in. I don't know what I would have done if I'd failed. I would have had to think about what to do. But luckily, I just drifted in, and it was what I wanted to do as a child, and it worked out all right. And I then had a full career rather than leaving halfway through. A lot of people leave after about 3 or 4 years. But I just wanted to stay on. I just enjoyed it more and more and more. There was only about 6 months in the entire time I was in the army I didn't really enjoy, actually. It was a great employer, and I had lots of opportunity, and I loved it.
You had a very successful career. You rose to a senior rank colonel, and as you describe, you've had quite a varied career in lots of parts of the world. But then something unexpected came along in 2011, is that correct?
It was very unexpected. I was just in the Congo, actually, which was an unusual place to be for a year and a half, disarming rebels. And I came back feeling very weak and sort of not quite myself. And I didn't really feel particularly ill, because you don't notice it, because Parkinson's creeps up on you. And I didn't know what was wrong with me at all. And my wife sort of was worrying about me. And my nephew, who's an army doctor, turned around and said, "You need to go and see a specialist." And I went, oh dear, what does that mean? And it took about 10 seconds for me to be diagnosed at the Thomas Cook Hospital up in Middlesbrough. And he said, "You've got Parkinson's. And the good news is it's not going to kill you," which is great, I suppose. "The bad news is it doesn't get any better, it gets worse. But there are pills, and take the pills, and you should be all right." So I was kind of given my marching orders and told to take the pills and just get on with it. And so for 10 years, that's kind of what I did. And I was sort of in denial, really, because it creeps up in a very slow sort of way. And you don't notice it at first. And the pills do actually work quite well. And I was busy, occupied with my work. The army carried on employing me in the normal sort of way. So it really didn't actually affect me too much. And only of late as it started to do so, because I went on this epic trip straight after retiring, so I was on the go all the time. And only when you'd stop to rest and sort of think about what's going on do you realise you can't do half the things you used to be able to do before. And then you start to notice it, and then your mind starts to play tricks on you. And the more you think about it, the worse it becomes in a funny way.
I guess many people in that situation would have a wide range of emotions. Obviously something comes at a great shock. But you decided to carry on working, and the army were able to support you with that.
I spoke to the general I was about to go and work for, because I was between jobs. And I rang him up and said, "General, I just need to tell you I've been diagnosed with Parkinson's." He said, "Doesn't matter at all. Just tip up work, do what you can. There are people with all sorts of problems, missing arms and legs and blind in that one eye or whatever it happens to be. And the army is a very caring organisation." And it was very, very caring indeed. And I had as much latitude as I needed. And the way we work is that you do what you can. And I wasn't going to get promoted again. I couldn't deploy in operations, obviously, because without the build, I'm not very effective. But I relied upon people around me much more than other people might. But as a team, I contributed as much as I would have done before. And I'd like to say the last job I did in the Army, the Royal Army Corps, was one of the best I did, when I contributed the most, with my views and my experience and my considerations, if that makes sense. And that seemed to go down quite well. And because I couldn't do certain things, I had to trust people around me, and that sort of brought them on. And we're quite a collaborative organisation. If you trust people to get on and do things on your behalf, then they respond positively to it. And it seemed to work quite well, actually.
You did eventually decide to retire in 2019. What was the plan then? Did you have any plan, or was it just, well, let's take it as it comes?
I knew I wouldn't be able to get an ordinary job, because I couldn't, because I was honest with myself to recognise that, you know, I can't write very well, I can't take notes, I can't remember what has been said, I can't attend meetings because I can't fall asleep in the middle of the midst of stuff. So nobody in the right mind was going to pay me lots of money to do what I had to do. The army pension was enough to live on, I thought, as long as I didn't have a big house, didn't spend my time going on lavish holidays, didn't buy too much champagne, then I should be able to live on my pension. And my wife was working at the same time. So I felt that it was not realistic to go and apply for a job. So at the same time, I had this dream to go and travel through Africa, which I'd had since I joined the army. In fact, before I joined the army, when I was at school, the dream started. And I suddenly had time, and I had a pension, and it wasn't the cost much to do it. So I thought, well, let's go and do that. I did a resettlement course, because the army pays for you to go and be trained, tested, go and do different things. And I went to my tutor, and she said, what are you planning on doing? And I said, nothing at all. And she said, well, that's unusual. Then, what do you mean? And I explained I had Parkinson's. She said, well, do you have any plans to do anything at all? And I said, well, I'm probably going to travel through Africa. And she said, well, what you need to do is, rather than just drift away and sort of potter along in a drifting sort of fashion, you want to focus on it and make it a purposeful event. And that's exactly what I did. So I decided at that point to do the trip, but to make it very obvious that I was raising awareness for Parkinson's. Not raising money, because other people do that. Not trying to find drugs or find a cure, others doing it, but just raising awareness of it. Because so many people think they know about Parkinson's, but people don't know as much as is actually going on. Because we only ever get out when we're feeling in a good spirit, and you never see us at our worst. And so therefore, if you don't live with somebody with Parkinson's, or you don't have it, you don't really understand what it's like. So at home, I was going to show people, by being honest about myself and doing a podcast and that sort of stuff, that I would try and describe exactly what it's like to have it. And at the same time, to raise people's awareness of what it's like in Africa, because it's in Africa as well. It's not just in the West. It's not just Europe and North America. It's a worldwide phenomenon. And in other countries, especially in parts of Africa, people are treated very differently to the way we are in the UK. And they've got no drugs, and they've got no neurologists, and they're stigmatized this disease, that it makes it almost impossible to live with them. So I want to draw attention to that as well.
So just to clarify, what you ended up doing was driving from London to Cape Town with a bit of an enforced break brought about by COVID, but we'll come to that in a moment. But yes, you say that it's stigmatized in Africa. I guess that would be the case in other parts of the world as well. You'd been deployed in Africa. I think your last deployment, I think you said, was in the Congo. Why was Africa so important rather than, I don't know, South America or any other lesser developed part of the world?
That's quite a good question. There are two reasons, I think. First of all, Africa has a special appeal. It's very romantic. The dark continent, all that sort of stuff. And it's one of those places you hear lots about. And the Stanleys and the Livingstone that speaks this world when they're doing their exploring. It's built into sort of childhood myth and all the rest of it. And it's a very exciting place to be. Further to that, it's actually quite easy to get there. You just have to drive across Europe and then across the Straits of Cadiz, and you're into Morocco. And before you know it, you're there. Thirdly, I'd actually been to the Sahara before, and I love the Sahara. I think it's absolutely wonderful. It's the most beautiful part of the world. It's clean and it's crisp and it's just glorious and great fun to explore. And also the people in Africa, when you get to know them, are fantastically friendly, and they laugh and they smile and they sing and they dance. And that's what they do most of the time. So it's a really good fun place to be. So for those sort of reasons, I thought, well, that's the place to go. I literally got in the car at Sanford Orcus, just north of Sherbourne, drove up the A303, went down the road to caught the ferry from Dover or wherever it was, into France, and carried on driving. It was almost as simple as that.
Well, tell me about the practicalities of this. Having made this decision to drive down through Africa and raise awareness, which is, you know, a wonderful thing to do, the practicalities of it are huge, aren't they? First of all, what about the vehicle? I mean, where did you acquire something suitable to make that kind of journey?
I've had a lot of time to think about vehicles, and I took a VW camper van, an ordinary camper van, but it's four-wheel drive with some modification. And that's for two reasons. One is because it's what I had. too, because when I went across the Sahara in 1987, we were followed by an American couple in a four-wheel drive camper van then. And I thought that's the way to do it. This wonderful machine, the old Type 2, 2.5, or Type 3, with the engine in the back, was a great machine. I had one of those anyway back in the UK, but it was too rusty and too tired and too old to make the journey, so I swapped it for a new one. And so that's why I chose it, because I kind of had it. VWs are great. And, of course, what the reality is that most people in Africa drive two-wheeled cars. They drive Renaults and Toyotas all over the place, and they don't actually need four-wheel drive most of the time. As long as you choose the right route, and when you have a bit of difficult ground, you traverse it carefully, you can get through in almost anything. You don't need to have some muscle-bound, earth-moving 4x4. Although it's jolly handy to have four wheels turning at the same sort of time. As it turns out, the van was pretty good, except it did break down a couple of times, entirely my own fault. So I had some problems with spare parts, which is a real drama, because there's nobody giving VW spare parts between really Morocco and Namibia. So I had to have them flown out to me, or people come and visit with them in their hand luggage. So the spare parts was a problem. But the vehicle itself was ideal, because what you can do with a VW camper van, which you can't do with a Land Rover or a Toyota or anything like that, you can live in it rather than out of it. You know, you can shut the door, pop the roof up, and you can eat inside, you can live inside, you can keep yourself secure. And because I was travelling by myself, I had to be able to look after myself quite carefully like that. Because if I'd lived outside the vehicle, I'd have doors open and people would come and nick things and help themselves to bits and pieces, which actually nobody ever did. People were always friendly, but I was always wary of that. So that's another big plus for a VW camper van. And they're glorious machines. Great machines. They work brilliantly.
So how long did you take planning this before you actually set out? You had this idea, and presumably your wife was supportive and others around you said, yes, go for it. It must have taken a bit of planning before you actually set out.
Well, there are two ways to look at it. Either it took 30 years of planning, ever since I first thought of the idea when I was at school. And that was triggered by the cover of a book I received at the post of some Land Rovers in the desert. I just thought, that's what I want to do. It was wonderfully evocative. So either a long, long time or no time at all. Because I left the army in 2019, working till the last minute, left in October, and in the middle of November I left for France. So I left almost immediately. But in my last job in the army, I spent a fair bit of time preparing the vehicle, getting sort of under armour put on, rudder suspension, doing some bits of the inside of it to make it more suitable to live in for one person, making sure I had all the right bits and pieces I needed to carry for spares, which were obviously the wrong bits, as it turns out. Made sure I had recovery equipment, which I forgot to use because I was panicking at the time. Taking lots of unnecessary stuff, which I ended up dumping along the way. But basically, I didn't spend too long panicking about it, because most of the time you can just get into a vehicle, and as long as it's reliable and you look after it, you don't need too much. And visas I was going to buy along the way, because that's the easiest way to do it, because I was never quite sure how long it would take to get to each country in turn. I was going to run things fairly smoothly, and stop in the capital city of each country, and then plan visas for the next two countries ahead, that sort of thing. And so everything was done kind of on the hoof. I was in no rush to come back. I had time on my hands. I didn't have a job to come to. I wasn't on holiday. I could take as long as it took, if you know what I mean. So there was no panic. It was a wonderful freedom, actually.
And what about the practical implications of your condition? You presumably had to take medication with you sufficient to last you the whole time you were away.
I took tons of medication, because I'd done about 12 or so pills a day at that point. So there's a lot of pills, and that takes up a lot of space. But I did actually start to run out when I got to Sierra Leone at one point. So luckily, COVID came, and I had to come back and get some more, which that worked out quite well. But I wasn't tied to a GP, so that was quite difficult. I was kind of ignorant rather than ignorant, and stubborn as well. And I thought, well, it won't be a problem. I can drive normally. I'll just carry on driving. What could possibly go wrong? And if I feel a bit tired, a bit knackered, I'll just stop and rest. And that's exactly what I did. So I stopped by the side of the road a lot of times. As soon as I feel myself getting a bit weak and a bit wobbly, I just pull over and just shut the doors, go and have a lie down in the back, because you can, and take the pills and wait for it to pass. Then off I go again. I was determined not to rush and determined not to be stressed by anything, because stress brings on the worst conditions, and I start to become more and more useless with stress. So therefore, if I had to be in a certain place by a certain time, I'd allow ample time to be there, so that I'd be there days in advance sometimes. That meant that I was in the right place at the right time and I had nothing to worry about.
Tell me about the experience generally. You went there to raise awareness of Parkinson's in Africa, and you've already alluded to the fact that it's treated with some suspicion. It's not fully understood in some countries, and I think the article makes reference to it even being looked upon as witchcraft in one or two countries in Africa. How did you set about overcoming those kind of challenges? What was the agenda? How did you try and start changing attitudes?
Well, the first thing was to find out where people were. And I spoke to people in Parkinson's Africa, which is a wonderful charity which focuses on Parkinson's in Africa, obviously. And they gave me some top tips and people to visit along the way and some meetings to make. And sadly, with time, you had to stick to, which is always a bit tricky. That meant I could meet people along the way, which is great. Secondly, because I was recently connected to the army, I speak to the British embassies and High Commission through the Defence Attaché and got access to their media people and their medical outreach teams. And they would help me meet people along the way as well. And they, through the media, I appeared on television and radio and in newspapers and articles in most countries, 20 or so, 30 times or so, television, for example. Lots and lots of example times on interviews. And the news would get out and people would ring up and sort of make contact with me. And then I'd again meet them and sort of just have a chat and film them and have a talk with them. And that was the aim of the game, was to reassure people that I met along the way that they weren't the only people who had Parkinson's, to explain that I had it, and if they wanted to, they could go and do, well, they can't because they haven't got drugs, of course, but they didn't have to be abandoned, because in some places, this witchcraft thing is very serious. Not every country, of course, not every country. But in some places, because it's such an extraordinary disease that has no cause and no cure, and manifests itself in a pretty unpleasant way with shaking and wobbling, not in my case, but it really floors people, there's no explanation for it, and so therefore it must be some sort of witchcraft. They must be cursed. They must have something wrong with their lives. And worse than that, they are often deemed to be contagious, so therefore they should be abandoned. And it is absolutely the case in some countries. People are just left to themselves, their own devices, and willingly, because they don't want their family to catch it. So they go and lock themselves away and die a slow and lingering, miserable, horrible death.
Now, we mentioned before that COVID intervened early 2020. You found yourself in Sierra Leone. And I guess the question was, do I continue or, you know, have I got to accept the reality and go back home for a while? You ended up coming back for a couple of years, didn't you?
Well, I had a few choices because at that point I wasn't completely sure I'd make it all the way to South Africa. And I was thinking, do I come back from Sierra Leone anyway? Do I try and go east and cross Africa and go around the Sahara and back up through Cairo? Do I come back from Sierra Leone a different route through different countries? Or do I do something different, come by boat or whatever? So all these were rushing around my mind. And just before I got to Freetown and it became a big issue, I thought to myself, well, I'm going to go the whole way now. I don't get the chances very often. Nigeria and Congo and Angola will be difficult, but I'll worry about that no other time. What can go wrong, sort of thing. I was slightly naive, I have to say, but naivety is quite a good thing because it means you don't worry about things you don't need to worry about. So I thought, well, I'll give it a go and see what happens. And of course, at that point, suddenly borders started to close down and I was stuck in Sierra Leone. And it was just when Italy, if you remember, was having those huge numbers of people dying with COVID and it was on its way to the UK. And it seemed to me at the time that Africa was better prepared because they're used to things like Ebola and they're quite good at isolation. And when they have a lockdown, they have a proper lockdown, nobody's allowed out of the streets, this sort of stuff. There's no messing around. There's, you know, if you stay at home, you jolly well stay at home unless you've got a letter to let you out. So there's no excuses. So they were quite good at controlling, containing. And there were very few cases at the time in Africa. But I was persuaded that if I did get it, that the hospital conditions are not as good as the UK. So it would have been actually quite serious for me. So therefore, I ought to go back. So I thought, well, I take the wise advice of these expat Brits. I will go back to the UK. And then caught the last flight. Well, I didn't. I booked on the last flight back, which was then cancelled. And I was evacuated by the embassy on one of their flights. So made it back to the UK, thinking I'd be back for about 3 months. So I left my vehicle in the care of somebody I'd met briefly before. Literally, I'd only met these people, the travellers, for 2 weeks or so. And so I said, would you mind if I left my vehicle in your garage? I said, no, not at all. Leave it. It's absolutely fine. And then somebody said, it'll take a year. I thought, that can't possibly take a year. And then, of course, eventually, 2 years later, I returned to find my vehicle was still there waiting to go.
But you did return after 2 years, and fair to say that the symptoms hadn't improved in that period of time. But were you able to go back to it? Yes. Were you able to go back to it as planned or not?
Well, to be honest, it was very clear that I had got worse, because you don't notice things getting worse on a daily basis. But going back to the wagon and doing all the things and moving stuff around, I thought either everything had got heavier or it got bigger or it got more sort of difficult to do, or else I was getting weaker and more feeble. And I think it was me getting weaker and more feeble. So I was suddenly very conscious that things weren't as easy as they were before. And so I would have to be quite careful how I did things. And indeed, it is the case that I suddenly thought, maybe I can't do this in the way that I could before, because maybe I'm not as good as I was before, and that's probably the case. So whereas I started alone and was very happy being alone and I could do everything by myself, I suddenly thought, can't do this by myself anymore. You know, changing tyres is going to be quite a struggle. Just doing all the things, it's all the boring things, like getting money out of your wallet, parking the vehicle up and going and keeping an eye, all sorts of stuff, which is not quite so easy alone. And so I suddenly thought that this is going to be more troublesome. But luckily by then I'd met a chap called Rob Haywood, a filmmaker, and he wanted to come make a film of what I was doing, which I'd agreed to. So he started to spend quite a lot of time with me and came out four times along the way and spent sort of 2 or 3 weeks each time driving with me and doing a lot of the admin and goodness knows what, as well as filming. He did tremendous credit to him. And we had a great time together. So life was a bit different. And I wasn't by myself as much as I wanted to be, because I actually quite like being by myself, because you get to meet people in a different sort of way. And people are far more accommodating, and they let you into their households, and they don't mind one person being there. And they take sympathy on somebody, a grey-haired old git like me, who's obviously not capable of doing things. They're very sympathetic, and they were incredibly kind to me. And they might not have been if there had been two of us, you know what I mean.
So you eventually did complete the trip, and you made your way to Cape Town. Any sense of, well, what was the feeling then? Was it relief, it's all over? Was it, you know, euphoria, I've done it? Or a slight sense of disappointment that it was over?
It was very strange. Elation and deflation, I say. Towards the end, I said to myself, what would I do if I was by myself? And the answer is just get this bloody thing done and out of the way. I'd been away a long time. I was wary about things not working on the wagon and things starting to go wrong a bit. And I had a horrible time in Gabon waiting for things to happen. My son came out, the visa didn't work, and I couldn't. The vehicle had another suspension problem. All sorts of dramas, much of which were my own fault. And so I was quite keen to get it over and done with while I was still in one piece. But I thought, you know, if we don't get this crack now, what could go wrong next? You're not sure what's going to be, but there could be something anywhere around the next corner. So I was just keen to get it done. It was a very flat moment when I arrived in Cape Town. Rob was with me, and I just sort of got in the car park and thought, well, that's it. There's no champagne, no, not even a beer. I was just very tired and wrung out, actually. And it was 30 years of dreaming, 3 years of travelling and COVID. And it all comes to an end. And what was next? What was I going to do next to beat that after my lifetime's dream was over? And I felt quite sort of downbeat, if the truth be known. It was a funny feeling. I was very relieved to have completed it, very pleased to have completed it, but I was very downbeat about what happened next, you know, because all I had to look forward to was more Parkinson's disease and no excuse, nothing else to go and do. So I had to sort of, I had to decide what to do next at that point.
Well, what you have done next, I mean, that was December 22, you've written a book called Running on Empty, and the profits are going to Parkinson's charities. That must have been another interesting experience, assuming you've not written a book before. Maybe you have. You know, it's quite an exercise sitting down and writing 80,000 words.
During lockdown, I started to sort of write my own sort of, as many people did, my own sort of life history, just to remember things and record things. So I started writing things anyway, by chance. But I'd been persuaded by enough people that there was a story in this, and an interesting story at that, which people would want to know. And I was doing something on Polar Steppes, so I was publishing photographs and stories and doing a blog and goodness knows what, which seemed to be quite popular. And I thought, well, maybe people actually do want to know about this. And more importantly, there is a story to tell about the people with Parkinson's in Africa, because nobody talks about them very much. So I was really keen to get the word out. And I had time. So with help from my niece, who's a publicist, who got me an editor and goodness knows what, I started scribbling away, and the book is now ready to go and is published on the 11th of April, I think it is, isn't it?
11th of April, indeed. And how can people get a copy if they'd like to do so?
Well, it'll be in every good bookshop, I'm sure. I mean, I hope it will. But it's easy to get on Amazon, of course. Just type my name in, or Running on Empty, onto Amazon. There's another book called Running on Empty, which is about something different altogether, but it's very obvious, the one with a picture of me and my vehicle on it, and hopefully it'll be a bestseller, I'm sure. Yeah, it's available through Amazon already as a pre-order, and I've had some lovely comments back about it already, so I think it's actually quite a good read.
You're doing a couple of local talks as well, aren't you, for anybody who may be interested?
Well, the other part of the story is, I could just stop and go home and lie and put my feet up and do nothing at all, but that wouldn't be very conducive. It would be a waste of my efforts of a year's worth of travelling. And to make the most of what I've done, you need to tell people what you've learned and what you've seen and what you've heard and what good you've done or what bad you've done and what tricks you've learned. So I'm doing a series of presentations around the country, really, including from Lye Village Hall up to London, up to Edinburgh, everywhere, really. And I'm available to talk to anybody who wants to hear me. And the idea is to raise a bit of money for charity, for Cure Parkinson's in particular, Parkinson's Africa, and a little charity I'm setting up called the Deakin Foundation, which is purely to give the lowest level of help, the lowest level of people that need it. So the chap who wants to pay for a taxi to go and visit somebody with Parkinson's, or who wants to book a village hall in some town or some village in Africa, but they haven't got any money at all. It's that sort of level which is below the radar for most charities, because a small amount of money goes an extremely long way, and one or two people can make all the difference to a complete population, a complete community in Africa. just by talking about it and being there. And so that's what the money will go towards, is just helping people at the lowest level. And it'll be a very simple place for them to apply for grants, and we will support them, because, well, I've seen people who've done tremendous good with no money whatsoever. They can't even afford to get bits of paper under a photocopier.
Okay, so assuming people may find it more convenient to go to Live Village Hall than to Edinburgh, what date can they see you there?
I think if it's Sunday, the 7th of April rings a bell.
I think that is a Sunday, yep.
And we're doing one there. But if anybody can't make that, and they can get a group of people together, I'm more than happy to travel and talk to people and tell them my story. As long as it's not too far away, I have time on my hands, because I don't intend to go and do any more work for a while, any real work beyond this. And so I'm happy to get out and about and spread the word. But Live Village Hall is pretty much the first thing coming up.
Guy, it's a tremendous story. I feel we've only scratched the surface of it. But thank you very much for telling us thus far. And we look forward to the book and hearing you in person around the Sherborne area.
I'm happy to talk to anybody whenever. But thank you very much for having me on your podcast. And I hope people enjoy the book when they get to read it.
Thank you, Guy.
The Sturminster Newton Boxing Club goes from strength to strength, with arguably the star of the show being Ruby Elswhite, who seems consistently to be picking up medals wherever she competes. Just recently, some of the club's top girl boxers returned from Sweden, having competed in the Golden Girls Championship there, and they did very well yet again. Sean Weeks is the man who set up the club over 20 years ago, with one of its aims being to try and get young people off the streets and off drug and alcohol abuse. So when I spoke to Sean some 10 days ago, I wondered if that aim had worked.
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of the children that we've had in over those years, a lot of them have come in that were on that route going into trouble. And we've sort of turned them around, turned their lives around, and gone on to do really well.
And you're going from strength to strength at the moment, aren't you? Largely on account of your girls.
Yes, indeed. When Ruby started training with us, she was the first. Well, she wasn't the first female. We'd had a couple previously that done okay, got to national finals, but never actually won the national title. And then Ruby came along, and she's taken the world by storm, pretty much. And that's highlighted the females within the club, and I'm sure that through her, it's inspired others to take the sport up. And we've got a really good team now.
And how young was Ruby when she first started with you?
Her first session, she was 7 years old.
My word.
Yeah.
And she is now what age?
17. She just turned 17 in February.
And when she arrived, you looked at her, what did you think?
After the end of her very first session, I actually said to everybody that day, if I can keep her interested in this sport, I will make her a champion. And that was on the grounds of her speed, her strength. She couldn't box at that time, obviously, but just her hand speed and the power she was punching with.
So her fists were all over the place initially, were they?
They was, yeah. She wasn't horrendous, but it was, you know, obviously there was work to be done.
And of course, she's been, I mean, Ruby has now picked up how many national and international awards? It's quite a few, isn't it?
In total, yeah. She's been the national champion, English champion 5 times now, Tri-Nations champion twice, European champion twice, and she's just about to, or she's actually on her way to Luton Airport as we speak, to fly over to Knock in Ireland for a 5-day prep camp with the England squad before she flies out on the 1st of April to Croatia, looking to win her 3rd European title.
And so when you see her on her way like that to take part in yet another important competition, do you still have your heart in your mouth or not?
Yes, yeah, I still get really nervous for her, as I did the very first time she got in the ring. Obviously fairly confident she can do what she needs to do. But yeah, it's always a heart and mouth moment, always.
So now she's now about to head off for yet another major competition. But, of course, the really big one is the Olympics, isn't it? I'm assuming you and she have got gold in your sights.
Her dream from day one was to represent Great Britain in the Olympics. And, yes, that is still her main goal. She can't compete in this Olympic because she's too young. She has to be a senior, which means she needs to be turning 19 of the year of the Olympics. Unfortunately, she's 2 years too young. So 2028 is her target in LA. And she'll... we're hoping to come back with gold.
Well, of course. And what category will she be in then, in the 2028 Olympics?
She'll be in the under 50 kilo category, I would have thought by then. Possibly even up to under 52, which would be super flyweight.
So it's not a question of age then, is it?
Not then, no. Once she turns 19, or the year she turns 19, she becomes a senior. So there's no upper limit, well, up until the age of 40. Unfortunately, with amateur boxing, you have to retire at the age of 40. But yeah, she'll be boxing anybody from 18, turning 19, to the age of 40 once she turns senior in 2 years' time.
Now, who, Sean, at the moment is your youngest girl boxer?
The youngest one at the moment, we've got Molly Calloway, who is still 10. Just brought her back from Sweden. She took her over to Sweden for the Golden Girls Box Cup, and she won the gold medal over there. We've got two 11-year-old girls there as well, in Ruby Gibbon and Mariah Ivanova. Both we've taken over to Sweden, and Mariah won a gold medal this year. Ruby only got a silver this year, but we took her the year before, and she got a gold the year before.
Now, you've got, slightly confusingly, Sean, you currently have two Rubies in your, don't you?
We do. We have Big Ruby, who is really only a small Ruby, and then Little Ruby. So, yeah, a little bit confusing when we talk about Ruby, because, we, like you say, we've got two of them now. And both doing, you know, I would say the crop of girls we've got now are technically better than the Big Ruby at the same age. They're not as strong or as quick, but certainly technically better than Ruby was.
So just as much potential for winning prizes?
We think so, yes. We're quite excited.
Now, the younger Ruby, as you say, this gets confusing. The younger Ruby is Ruby Gibbon. Are you lining her up to step into Ruby Elsewhite's shoes when Ruby can no longer compete as a girl?
The age gap only being 5 years, they'll be competing together, hopefully, not against each other. But we got Ruby, little Ruby Gibbon. She's going into the schools championships this year, and the entry forms have just come in. So that will start tail end of April and run into May. So we're hoping that she'll make at least the finals weekend up in Newcastle. So, yeah, we're hoping she's going to follow in her footsteps, and hopefully we'll have unboxing on the same shows as well in the future.
Sean, I imagine that much as you might like to go and cheer your girls on at each and every competition they take part in, especially overseas, you're not really able to do that, I guess.
Not all the time. Obviously, when Ruby's boxing for England, she's out there for like 17, 18 days. So obviously, I run my own business as well, so I can't be away for that amount of time. But certainly if she gets to the final, I shall make every effort to pop out if it's only for a 1 or 2 day stay, as I did when she boxed over in Italy.
And I should imagine, you know, that if you're the fact that you're there with them must really must have a good positive psychological effect on them.
Yeah, I would have thought so, to know that we're supporting them as well as when they're working with other people. You know, it's nice to be there for them. And you know, when they work with the England team, they don't know them as well and haven't got the same relationship that they've got with us. So, yeah, I think it is good to have us there to give them the support they need.
And their parents too, of course.
Indeed, yes. Yes, they get there as often as they can.
I'm sure they do. I mean, I wonder what most parents feel when their little girl, you know, says, well, I'd like to go and join the Sturmester Newton Boxing Club and be a boxer. What do you think most parents think about that?
I would say for the mums, I would say it was quite terrifying. I even know from my own experience, from my wife, when my son was boxing, she could hardly ever watch. She always watched through her hands over her eyes with her fingers open a little bit. And yeah, was always nervous about it. So I'm assuming it'll be the same with the mums with their daughters. But you know, it's a good sport. They obviously worry. The mums probably worry about them getting hurt. But if they were getting hurt and they didn't enjoy it, they wouldn't keep coming back.
No, of course not. No, and I mean, I can imagine if I put myself in their shoes, I would worry about black eyes, broken noses, and broken jaws, or worse.
I mean, the safety aspect of amateur boxing now is got a lot better. So it's not that often. They have to wear head guards. They've obviously got mouth guards as well. So it's not that often they end up with nosebleeds or broken noses or black eyes. It's quite rare.
That's very encouraging to hear. Sean, it must still be a relatively small sport internationally, women's boxing, in terms of the number of top girl boxers. So I imagine they know each other quite well on the circuit, the top boxers, and end up boxing the same people.
You do get that, yeah. Once you get to the level that Ruby's at now, it's difficult to find her opponents in this country, especially, or even like as we call on club shows, because of her extremely good record. There's only a couple of girls now in this country, I would say, that would actually get in the ring with her. So she's restricted to what we call box cup competitions, which you enter, which are normally held over a long weekend, where you have a box off. And all major competitions. Other than that, she's not going to get out on the club circuit very often now, which is a shame. But that's just the way it goes. You reach that level, and that's what happens.
You become a member of the elite then, and there aren't too many of those.
That's correct, yes.
So you must have now recently, of course, your girls competed in the Golden Girls Championship in Sweden, and your club was nominated Best Club.
Yes, that was a bit of a shock and a surprise to gain that award. There was over nearly 400 competitors in between 60 and 80 boxing clubs from all over Europe. So for us to pick up that award was certainly an honour.
And I imagine that's something that you'd like to hang on to.
Indeed, yes. We're hoping to go out there with a bigger team again next year. Each year we've gone with more girls. We've just had another female boxer rejoin us. She was with us before. Again, the 12-year-old Ebony Isaacs. So she's shown a very tidy boxer. And we've got a couple still coming through our Fun Box Club that we've recently moved up to our Beginners Club. And then when they're old enough, when they turn 9, we will instantly move them up to our main club because there's a couple of girls in there that are showing great potential. So, yeah, the girls' team's getting bigger and bigger, which is brilliant.
So you'll be the club to beat then, won't you?
Getting that way, yes, definitely.
You mentioned the Fun Box. What sort of age are the girls who do that? And boys as well, presumably. I mean, let's not forget you've got boys too.
Indeed, yeah. Now we have boys and girls in the Fun Box Club. That is geared up for 5 to 9-year-olds, where we teach them the basic skills of boxing. And then they do a test each week, which is similar like press-ups, sit-ups, burpee jumps, all that sort of stuff. And then we do tests with skipping. And then they finish up after doing 9 tests. They do one a week. We then do a assessment with them on the pads. And they work towards getting different certificates. So we work with a bronze, silver, gold, and an elite. Once they've completed them, which takes just about a year, they would then move on to level 2, level 3, and level 4. To date, we've been running the Fun Box Club for about 10 years now, and we've only had 2 make it to the end of level 4.
And so, but I imagine that once hooked, do they stay hooked on boxing?
I think so, yeah. If they, we get a lot that come and only last 2 or 3 weeks, 3 or 4 months. If they get through the first year, then they're normally stayers, yes.
It's interesting, you know, finally, Sean, it's interesting that women have been boxing. We always think of it as a male, predominantly male sport, which it is. Women have been boxing for almost as long as the sport has existed, but only recently have they been allowed. I mean, as I understand it, the first license was not issued in this country until 1998.
Yeah, that's probably correct, yeah. Probably Jane Crouch was the first one that really sprung to mind that brought women boxing to the forefront. But certainly now, I mean, even at the O2 Arena in London hosted its first ever all-female professional show only just last year. So, and they're looking to do that again. I've got sort of contacts with Sky Sports through a couple of people that used to live locally, and they sort of keep me informed of what's going on. So, they're looking to do an all-female show again within the next 12 months, which is great.
And getting more and more coverage in terms of TV and so on?
Definitely, yes. I mean, there was even recently a male and female show where the Katie Taylor actually headlined it. So they're even starting to headline male shows as well, which is brilliant. It's brilliant for female boxing.
Is your club expanding then? Since you're obviously attracting more girls, so you... I'm imagining that maybe you're going to have to move to bigger premises in Sturminster.
That might be a possibility, yes. I mean, the numbers are going up, obviously, not only with the females, but even with the male boxers. And they're doing really well now. They're stepping up to the mark, as they have to now, because the girls are outshining them. We've got a lad boxing this weekend, Freddie Norman in Loughborough, for the national junior title. He's boxing in the semi-finals weekend. And we have looked at another premise, just on the outskirts of Sturmsonewton at Rose Mill, which is bigger than what we've got now. The tricky bit's going to be the rent. What we're paying now and what we'd have to pay if we took that one on is five times as much. So it would make sure that if we did move, we could sustain the rent and keep it affordable for the people that take part.
Because you do also rely, it's not just membership fees that you rely on for funding, is it?
It's not, no. We rely on all the local businesses who, I have to say, have been absolutely fantastic in supporting us in sponsorship deals, sponsoring for our main shows that we put on, that we do twice a year. Also, the Box Cup competitions that we enter, we get local businesses to sponsor that to make it affordable for us to do. So, we do rely on them. And the town council as well. We've just received a £750 grant from them, which is really good.
And to come back to Ruby, Sean, can you see her turning professional at some stage?
That is the dream, yes. The plan was pretty much always try and win as many national titles as she can through her junior, her school's junior youth levels, move on to Team GB, hoping that her first major competition as a senior will be the Commonwealth Games in 2026. Hopefully she'll medal there. Then the Olympics in 2028. Again, hoping that we medal there. Gold would be fantastic, with a view of later that year turning pro. We're starting to put things in place at the gym now. I've already gained my pro coaching licence. Another coach at the gym, Eddie Wareham, has also got his. Later on this year, as you have to be a registered coach for 3 years before you can apply to be a professional manager. My 3 years come up in September, so September, October time, I'll be applying for my manager's licence as a professional. And then probably in 2025, we'll start looking at signing our first professional boxer.
So the Sturmsonewton Boxing Club will be very firmly on the international map.
That's what we're hoping for, yes.
Thank you so much, Sean. I really appreciate that. Well, I wish you, Sean, you and your girls, and the boys, of course, too, the very best of luck.
Thank you very much, Jenny. It's been a pleasure.
Welcome today to John Farrand, who is the Managing Director of the Great Taste Awards. John, thank you very much for joining us on the BV Magazine podcast.
Good afternoon, Terry.
This is very much a family affair, the awards, isn't it? Because your father set it up 30 years ago. I think your wife's involved as well. Just give us a little bit of a potted history.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I'm the Managing Director of the Guild of Fine Food, and we're based in Gillingham, Dorset, as well as a satellite office close to Borough Market in London. And yes, we amongst other things, organise Great Taste. Those other things are that we publish a trade magazine. We organise training for people who stand behind deli counters in farm shops and delis. We organise some exhibitions, and we also lobby government. We sit on various government panels, representing the very smallest food and drink producers and the excellent independent retailers, delis, farm shops, food halls that sell those products. So a small business, yes, 40 years old, yes, but we're based here in Gillingham in Dorset, but we kind of reach the world. We touch the world with our food and drink initiatives.
Well, that's good to hear that Gillingham has an international reach. Your dad, Bob, set it all up 30 years ago. Is that right? What was the thinking, the idea behind the Great Taste Awards?
Yeah, I mean, he's been publishing our magazine, Fine Food Digest, for longer than 30 years, actually, more like sort of just over 40 years. So he's been in and around the deli end of food and drink, and in particular cheese, funnily enough, for a long time. But he established the Great Taste Awards in 1993, and then it was launched in 1994. Really, he saw perhaps the dumbing down of food and drink, certainly in the UK. Before that, in the 80s, the supermarkets were really grabbing hold of food and drink retail and piling it high and selling it cheap. And And actually, the quality, let's say, of food and drink was perhaps being undermined, and people were wanting cheap food. And as we know, cheap food isn't necessarily good and worthy food. So the Great Taste Awards was launched, amongst other initiatives at the time, to try and remind the consumer that there are producers out there who care, who want to make great things with a simple ingredients listing. And Great Taste was really designed to shine a light on those producers. And the mechanism of judging improved them. It helped them improve, because every single entry gets some feedback and that goes back to the producer. And then really the point of giving awards, 1-star, 2-star, 3-star, is really just to give, I guess, a rating and to celebrate them. And that trade initiative, which is what it was initially, 10 or 15 years ago, the consumer kind of got hold of it and started to recognise those stars, largely because the producers were proud of winning awards. So they would talk about it to their customers at farmers markets, and the retailers started talking about it. So suddenly, and I'm quite sort of happy to admit, by accident, we've got a sort of consumer product now in Great Taste, that it's a recognisable brand.
It's gone from humble beginnings. I think you had something like 200 entries in the early years, whereas you've now got 13,500, I think, in this particular judging season, and entries from all around the world. So it really is an international scheme now.
Yeah, I mean, I think we had 246 entries year one. We've now just, I mean, we judge 14,000 products every year now. That's our capacity, really. It's what we can, you know, for us, the judging process is critical. We have to make sure that every entry gets a fair hearing. So there is only so much we can cope with over so many days with our panel of 500 judges. So that's why we kind of have a cap. But yes, it's grown. I think that's because the interest in food and drink has grown, quite frankly. And our end of food and drinks become more interesting. There's more people in there making great products. And so we've kind of grown with speciality food and drink, if you like, that sort of end of food and drink. But it's now become an operational task. And whilst on the outside, to perhaps people who see the Great Taste logo on shelves on food and drink, they think that the task of a judge and those behind it is rather a romantic one, it is actually a huge job of logistics. And we've got sort of specially constructed and written software and Excel spreadsheets on everyone's desktop, controlling the logistics behind this project. Because what we're essentially doing over 90 judging days is bringing people, the judges, our experts, into a room with about 1,000 products a week in two locations. Yeah, that needs some organising.
And the actual products which you're judging here are quite varied as well, aren't they? Because you go from something like a raw pepper all the way through, presumably, to a more finished product. Is that the case?
Yeah, we're a broad church, Terry, in many ways, actually. We pretty much will accept any entry as long as it's commercially available for sale. And that might be as simple as a farmer's market or someone who sells from their farm gate right the way up to the supermarkets. But we're also a broad church with the products that we judge. Because it's all blind tasted, our mantra is that you've got to let the process decide. There isn't a pre-qualifying round or an initial sift. There's a few products that are ineligible just simply because they're not in our market. Things like vitamin powders and things like that. We have to draw the line. And funnily enough, we don't judge wine simply because there are many other wine awards. But apart from that, we pretty much would accept any food or drink entry that you might see in a deli or a farm shop or a good grocer's.
And you make the point that it's not just, inverted commas, fine food like caviar. You can have things like sausage rolls as well, as long as it's an award-winning sausage roll.
Well, absolutely. And actually, I don't even know if we even have any entries of caviar really now. The point there is that a good pork pie is fine, can be excellent, and many are. Also, it's to make this sort of food and drink, it's important to stress that it's not in inverted commas, posh or unattainable, because well-made food can be inexpensive. It can be more satisfying, funnily enough, because it's made with better ingredients. And therefore, if you shop well, you can buy better food and it will satisfy you more than actually cheaper processed food and drink. So it's important that great taste heroes all types of food and drink, not just that's perhaps perceived as elite. Most farm shops are not elite in any way. They serve a community, they serve better value, and often cheaper, actually, fresh veg and fruit. Meat counters are often as good a value, serving better meat products. So we're trying to break down this barrier that food from independent retailers costs more and is somehow only for certain people. And that just, quite frankly, isn't right.
And tell me about the judging process. If you've got more than 10,000 entries, presumably people just don't send in ingredients from all over the world. So you end up with a big pile of packages of rotting food. There must be some kind of sifting process, I imagine, ahead of that.
Obviously, I mean, we judge every single one of the 14,000 products, and we have a very sort of sophisticated system of calling in a certain number of products each week in each judging location, so that goods in, and Friday is our goods in day, and we're recording this on a Friday. So downstairs, there's plenty of products arriving that will be processed and allocated to crates on shelves or in chillers or in freezers. And then the following week, they are assessed by our judges. And that process is a tricky one. When the food arrives at the table, our judges have about 16 products in front of them in a session being a morning and then a second session in the afternoon. And then that food and drink kind of goes on a journey. So the first table will assess it, talk about it. They work in teams of two or three. One of them has a laptop. One of the judges has a laptop to harness that feedback, which then goes back to the producer. And once they've given a rating or not to a product, it then goes to at least one other table. And for the higher stars, it will carry on a journey going to 3, 4, 5 teams potentially. And then our software sort of aggregates the rating that's given to end up with their final score. So it is romantic, but it is also an important job. And so we need to have robust systems to deliver that task.
Equally, there must be some system for comparing apples with oranges, if you like. So how do you compare, to take some of the examples in the article, Saudi Arabian honey with Panamanian peppercorns?
we have entries from 108 or 109 countries last year. I can't remember. So we get some esoteric products that are tricky to judge, but we rely on our experts having a broad training and a broad palate. So yes, we have specialists in different fields. We kind of mix them up, and our judging teams are important. You know, we have to have a balance of chef, food writer, retailer, and you have to work on those teams. So there's a mix of gender and discipline within food and drink and age. But the important word there is compare. We specifically ask them not to compare. Every single entry is judged on its own merit. So there can be 10 three-star honeys or none. Each individual product is judged, assessed, and given a rating. There is no compare. And that's why we prefer the system of giving them one bacon, one marmalade, one ice cream, one olive oil, rather than giving them a table full of the same product. There are a few categories that we do have to judge together, but that's more for operational reasons, i.e. tea and coffee, espresso, herbal infusions, things like that. But that's more of a operational task and dictated by the operational reasons rather than for judging reasons.
Okay, so there's no one winner in any particular category. You can have as many three-star entries as you feel are justified in any year. Who are the judges? From where did you locate them?
That's a good question. So we've been in this sector, as I said, for sort of 30, 40 years. We know people. We know the market. We know the industry. We have a lot of people submit an application to become a judge, and there is an application. It's not just a case of swanning up and having a lovely day. We do vet them, we ask for a biog, and we make sure that they have a palate of a certain standard, and that they've demonstrated that they've had a certain number of years in the food and drink industry. So The judges, to answer your question more specifically, are retailers and retail buyers, either from independents, some of the multiples. Judges are chefs, they're food writers, they're restaurant critics, they're food technologists. We have the odd producer themselves in the room, obviously not judging their own products, but we have a good mix of folk to come and be our experts.
And asking you to put modesty aside for a moment, John, this is now grown into one of the main international award schemes for food, hasn't it? Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I think it would. I think we say it's the most trusted. Is it the largest? I think it possibly is. I'm not sure there's any central records of the great and the good in the food accreditation scheme world. But anecdotally, we know that people across the planet see it. I get photographs from my friends who say, I spotted one of your great taste winners and I'm here in the Middle East, or I'm in Australia or Singapore or the US or Canada, as well as most of Europe. So, yeah, it's out there and it's trusted by the consumer, but it's also used by trade buyers. They almost use it as a sort of a buying guide to source products. And we have great taste retail promotions in Japan and South Africa, where they run their own promotions to sort of say, look, here's some great taste winners, come and enjoy them. There's a bit of point of sale about what Great Taste Awards is. So yeah, gently it's spreading the word. And it's important to spread the word because the producers with those stars are mostly small, making great things. And we need to help those people and we need to support the retailers that sell those sorts of products, because it makes life more enjoyable, more colourful. It's better for you and it helps local and rural economies so much more than spending a pound in a supermarket. So it's a very important end of food and drink, and it's where innovation happens, and we all owe it to support that sector.
Just to close on, John, give us a couple of examples. I put you on the spot. Something that's really blown you away and you thought, well, I never thought that was possible in whatever type of food it may have been, and maybe a quirky entry. What sort of really niche products do you see?
It's a tricky question, Terry, because it's blind tasted and all the entries have a code. The codes are so important to us. They go right the way through the process. So actually, a lot of the time, I'm looking at spreadsheets and not specific food and drink. But I will answer your question, because last year we had the most incredible soy sauce enter from Taiwan, I think. And this is probably a reflection of me, perhaps, but we buy soy sauce in this country, we use it in our cooking, and we buy what we can get in the shops here. But actually, when you taste something that is real and authentic and made how it should be, then actually it slightly changes your perception and blows your palate apart, because you just think, yeah, it's something else. And we cook with it now. It's just a wonderful, wonderful product. I guess it's a little bit like when you go and have breakfast in a hotel and the eggs are never up to it, but when you have your eggs from down the road from the hens, it's just like a fundamentally different product. They're just two different things. But that's the thing, I think, in the last year or so that's really blown my mind. But every year we see trends and we see fashions in great taste. I remember about 20 years ago seeing the first edible flower, which now is probably been and gone, actually. It's a trend that's happened. But that kind of surprised me, and that's what's rather nice about great taste, is you almost see the trends before we do see the trends before they happen. We were having kombucha and kefir about 6, 7, 8 years ago, and they're now really on message, and you know, fermented foods is a big thing, and that's, you know, we've had lots of entries there. And now we're seeing the increase in sort of low to no alcohol entries. That's becoming more and more important. People are coming up with great drinks to enjoy with food that don't contain alcohol. We had a 3-star winner last year called Saicho Drinks, which is essentially a tea-based sparkling wine, in inverted commas, because of course it's not wine, because there's no grapes anywhere near it. It's sort of made from tea. And that's a wonderful thing. There's always something. There's too many things to pick out, Terry, that impress every year.
No problem. Thank you, John. And thank you for coming and telling us about it. It sounds like a fantastic business you've got there. We wish you well for the future, and we look forward to seeing your logo on foods around supermarkets and elsewhere.
That's great. Yeah, it's an important business, but it's supporting an important sector. And as I always say, it's the food and drink makers that do the hard work. They're out there making it. And the independent retailers that sell it, they're the ones that need the support. But thanks for your time.
John, thank you.
And that's all for episode 2 of the March 2024 BV podcast.
Until next time, it's goodbye from me, Terry Bennett.
And it's goodbye from me, Jenny Dennett.